things. Okay. This is Dan Golodner, Walter P. Reuther Library, Wayne State University, interviewing Thomas Hobart, Boston, Massachusetts, at the AFT convention, July 22nd, 2006. So this is your first convention, not participating too much.
Sitting back. And normally I walk around the convention, so I know where everybody from New York is, you know, because I want to be able to catch people. And this time I'm just sitting and watching. Some very kind people come over and say hello to me, and that's different. But the educational reform, right?
Right.
The 70s were pretty much trying to build the operation we had, and then the Ronald Reagan appointed a committee, recently I've heard that the chairman of the committee did all these things, but it was really Terrell Bell, the Secretary of Education, that had done it, and the Nation at Risk came out, and as had been our modus operandi, you know, anybody that criticized any part of education, you know, we started to gear up to wham him. Now this report came out several days before the NYSED convention. So our delegates were coming in, and I think our delegates really expected us to really lambaste this, and we were prepared. And Shanker said to me, I'm going to do something different at the convention. Al had been executive vice president, then had moved on to AFT president and stepped down as executive vice president. But we still had him come every year to the convention and speak. And he would try to talk about some book that came out, or, you know, if we had a particular problem, to try to reinforce what we were trying to do. But he said, I'm going to do something different this time. He said, and it might be controversial. So, you know, this is Al Shanker. You know, Al Shanker, no. I'm going to cancel you off the agenda. So, you know, it was Al. So it was okay. And with Al, you know, Al had a thousand ideas a week. And by the next week, Al realized that 990 of those ideas, you know, were not good ideas, and Al would drop them. You know, we never had to pressure Al to drop for anything. You know, he came to that conclusion. And then the other 10 were, like, terrific ideas that he had. So I figured this is one of those. You know, this is like when he went to the press club and said we should have charter schools, or the National Board for Teaching or something. I figure that's what he's going to come up with.
Right.
He doesn't want to tell me ahead of time, so that's okay. So suspense and...
Oh, so he kept you in suspense this whole...
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So Al gets up and he starts talking about this report and saying that they're right. I said, geez, you know, this isn't going to go over very well, you know. Al's normally interrupted 20, 30 times of his speech with applause. There's no interruptions, you know, as Al is talking, you know, about...
Right. They're in stunned silence listening?
Yeah. His message was pretty much, if we expect to get more money for the schools, if the schools aren't doing the job they should do, and we expect to get more money, we better be in the forefront of trying to change those schools. And then we can justify the money that we're going to ask for.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got this obligation to the kids. So it was a, say if it was a trial balloon, it was a lead balloon. It really like sat there. But, you know, when Al was on a roll, Al's great ability was to explain things so well that... he really answered all your questions. You know, he was a magnificent large audience teacher. You know?
Right.
He could carry that audience. So everybody afterwards was sort of saying to themselves, well, you know, what the hell is Al doing? You know, he's undercutting us, doing all this and all this. But he's right. But he shouldn't say that, you know, because it undercuts us. But the more time went on, you know, people were saying, but he's right, sort of carried the day. So that started educational reform for us. We were no longer defending what we had out there, but we were starting to move ahead on how we were going to try to improve the schools. And not being embarrassed about the fact that we had some of the best schools in the world in New York, but that wasn't all of our schools.
Right.
And then we had to start to go to work on that. And you know, Antonio Cortez, Tony took off. Chuck Santelli was our director of research, supported her very strongly. You know, they really started working with the Commissioner of Education. Gordon Ambach was the commissioner at that time, and you know, Gordon was one that always kept his... I like Gordon. I'm not being critical of Gordon, but Gordon kept his finger in the air because the Commissioner of Education in New York is very political. You know, it's not an appointment of the governor. It's an appointment by the Board of Regents. You got to know what's happening. And they did an awful lot to convince Gordon that, you know, we should be... New York should be in the forefront of this. You know, we shouldn't be lagging behind. And that's how we got started in education reform.
Excellent. So what was some of the first education reform issues you tackled?
Well, it was very, very difficult. We'd had a commission in the late 70s on teacher education certification in practice, which had recommended a number of changes in the certification process of teachers, difference between licensing and certification, and licensing your practice uncertified. Unsupervised, certified, you practice supervised. And the commission had recommended an entrance exam for all teachers and a master's degree in a related area. And a lot of teachers in New York had master's degrees, but they were all over the park. They were not in related areas. So that was one of the first things that, you know, to improve the teacher corps that we had in the state, both as far as prospective candidates for teaching and also in service wise for the teachers that were in place. So that was the first thing that we really started out to do, and took quite a while in order to accomplish it. But New York is now one of the few states that has both a licensing exam and the requirement for a master's degree in a related area.
Really?
Which works almost every place except when you get to elementary, and then you got to say, what the hell is the related area for elementary school teachers? You know, there isn't, you know, if you're biology teachers, it's easy. You get a master's degree in biology, right? But
right.
If you're elementary school teacher, you know, that's harder. Maybe reading, you can get something in reading or guidance or, you know, something. But we have, you know, we still got that piece to go on. Really, what is the... What is the next educational level for an elementary school teacher in order to be able to help them to improve their practice in the classroom?
Right.
And then, then the other reforms started to come. And, of course, now we're in No Child Left Behind and trying to improve that. Now, the AFT was never opposed to being accountable. Shanker always said from the beginning that we got to prove to the taxpayers that they want to give us money. You know, we got to make the case. If we don't make the case, if the pundits are out there and knocking us down, why wouldn't the taxpayers believe them? So, the accountability. Antonia worked an awful lot on assessments. About how we get these assessments to be coordinated with the curriculum. We still haven't done that in New York. We haven't convinced the commissioner, the current commissioner, that we have to have a statewide curriculum. Rick Mills says, you know, I don't want to interfere with creative teachers.
Okay.
You know, if we restrict them to what they have to teach, they can't be creative. And we're saying, well, there has to be a body of knowledge that every sixth grader should have at the end of sixth grade, because we have a very mobile population in New York. A sixth grader on Long Island moves to Niagara Falls, starts seventh grade, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We don't want them learning all over what they learned in sixth grade, and we don't want them missing a whole contingent of knowledge when they start seventh grade. So there's got to be some standard. But it doesn't have to be 100%. You know, we would be willing to negotiate on what percentage, you know, 50%, 60%, 70%. And then the rest of the percentage you could leave to the local school district. And they could decide what is relevant for that school district. Maybe in urban school districts, they would want like more emphasis on African history. Or if you go up into a highly WASP area, maybe they want a Eurocentric history or something like that. But we would have that basic, whatever it is, 60 or 70% of the curriculum, that every child was being brought up to that level. Mm-hmm. When they left that grade, and then the next grade they're going to go on. And then they get something that is more colloquial, that,
right.
that they would be able to have. And then, if we get a curriculum that is in place, then we can have statewide tests, the tests that if they've made that progress that we want. And the other, the local part, if they want to test that, that's all right. They can test that some other way, and it'll be different from other school districts. But we would have that basic knowledge for every child, so that we weren't going to be losing kids, either because they were repeating what they already learned, or because they were missing an important ingredient to what they should learn. So we're still working on that in New York, and the AFT now has a report that's coming out about the coordination of the assessments to the curriculum and what states are doing a good job of it. And I'm very happy to say New York is one of the 11 that the AFT has identified that the assessments do reflect it. Now, New York had a leg up because we always have had the Regents exams.
Right. Right.
Which were recognized from the time I was in elementary school as a standard, and which was what had to be taught to. I mean, the Regents.
I always thought it was a standard.
Yeah. Regents Review Book was something that, you know, like you went down that Regents Review Book in order to make sure that you knew what the questions were going to be, because, yeah, you know, as a social studies teacher, I knew there were going to be two questions on Greek and Rome.
Yeah.
You know, and on World War II, there was going to be an awful lot of material. And so that's the next step that we have got to get to. Establish what the curriculum is. Test that curriculum. And then we will know if the kids are coming up to that level. And,
So we still
got some work to do, but we are... We are prodding along, and,
right.
and things are improving.
How are you getting the teachers to understand this? Do you do it through the teacher centers? Do you do it through publications? The whole thing, probably.
Well, all of the above. You got to use, because you don't get any teacher doing all of the things that you have. You know, you might only have one of them where a teacher attends that. They might read a periodical, or they might go to a teacher center. They might, you know, they might not do them all.
Mm-hmm.
So you better have these in there. Teachers are very upset about the testing requirement because one thing it does, it de-emphasizes a lot of important areas. There's going to be a testing component in science, but right now there's no testing component in science, and so therefore science is being de-emphasized for reading and math. You know, those are the two big things. So mm-hmm. if you run out of time, what are you going to drop? Well, you drop art, music, phys ed, science, history,
right.
you know, because you're not testing for those things.
Someone mentioned the other day, I'm sneaking in social studies.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, it's very tough. We don't want a curriculum that's a mile wide and an inch deep,
mm-hmm.
but we do want a child to experience all of these things. You know, maybe you as a student hate school, but you love drawing, and so you drag yourself in every day to draw, or you hate school and you come in every day because you're going to get your saxophone lessons.
Right.
You know, there's something that brings you to school, and you know you've got to do the other things in order to get this piece that you want. And so maybe we will have some great saxophone player, some great artist, you know, that comes out of that, which really didn't have a lot of interest in math and science and reading and writing and all of these other
right.
things. But it's the education of the whole child.
Right.
The reason that we spend the money on education in America and probably in all the other countries is, first of all, we have to train the citizen. Hopefully we're not socialistic so that we're not training them for the state, but we're training them for democracy.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make them prepared for the workforce. And, you know, for those two reasons, government is willing to give us a lot of money. And then we're probably able to sneak in the other pieces, like the arts and phys ed and the other parts of it, to have the whole person being developed within the school system. So we have a lot of work to go. And there's also the problem that everybody is in favor of equal educational opportunity, except we want our kid to have a little more.
Right.
And so we move to the suburbs, and where there's a good education system, we forget about the needs that we have in the city. And so we're going to have to, you know, care about those places that are being forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Even take our African-American middle-class population today. I mean, they want the best for their children. They want their children to have more than they had as far as education. And they know that they have a responsibility to their African-American community, but not at the sacrifice of their child. So they're going to move to the suburbs. And once they do, they're going to have less time for what went on back in the old neighborhood. You know, my parents came out of an Italian neighborhood, and we moved out of it. And once we did, there was a little less emphasis on the Italian culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because we were now assimilating to all the other new neighbors that we had, and we were, you know, and we still had the, you know, St. Joseph's Day that we celebrated, which the neighbors didn't celebrate. But it was like one day a year, whereas it used to be every day.
Right.
And it's the same for the new cultures that we have. That's going to happen. So we'll see. I'm on the National Commission at the Aspen Institute for No Child Left Behind, and we're trying to see what's good about No Child Left Behind and what should be changed in it.
What should be changed? I kind of know what the good is, and the AFT's been saying the good part, but what needs to be changed now?
Well, there's some very obvious things. You know, with every federal program, there's parts you say, God, how did this happen?
Right.
Like the disabled child is required to be tested. Now, there's another piece of legislation, IDEA, and I forget what IDEA stands for, but it's for the handicapped child.
Oh, yeah.
And it says that each child should have an individual learning profile. The teacher has to sit down with the administration and the parents and all that and say, what does this child need? Could be severely handicapped, could it be mentally challenged, could be, you know, what should this child have? And they work up, you know, what would be progress for that child, which is different from all the other children. You know, this is an individual. That's what it's there for. It's for individual. And then No Child Left Behind comes out and says every child has to be tested. So we're given these tests, these grade-level tests, to kids that can't do them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had people testify that, you know, their child comes home and hides under the bed because they thought, the child thought they were doing well. They were meeting their IEP. But then they took a test, and they couldn't answer any of the questions on the test. So all the work that had been done to motivate this child to, like, move ahead and to be able to do much more in society than they would have been able to do is lost because we're testing them. The ELL, the Limited Language Learner, now that would be LLL. Well, anyway, it's ELL, whatever the acronym comes out. But it's a child comes in, says that they have 3 years before they have to take a test. So we're hearing all this testimony about all the research says it takes 7 years to become comfortable in a language. So you go back into history, say, how the hell do we get to 3 years? If everybody agrees, 7 years is the minimum. I think it says 5 to 7. Everybody agrees on that. How do we get to 3? Well, the conservatives in Congress wanted 1. They want everybody that didn't learn English to get shipped back. And the progressives wanted the child to have a more liberal education. So the compromise was 3. So it has nothing to do with the reality, but it's compromised. So that should be changed. So there are a number of these things that that we think. And then the commission is going to have a meeting. And I think what will come out of the meeting, because I've listened closely to the other commission members, is that they're going to think that we should be moving towards a national standard. Right now, every state sets their own standard. And so we have a situation where New York has 1,000 failing schools and Alabama has none. The difference is that Alabama's standard is a lot lower than New York's standard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yeah. So in evaluating the use of the federal funds, is that what we should have? Or should we say that the kids from Alabama might be working in New York one day, and so they should have the same standard
right.
as the New Yorkers have? So those are some of the things that, you know, that the commission is looking at to change, because we recognize it's a bipartisan bill. There were Democrats. You know, Miller from California was a Democrat, pushed as hard for this as any of the Republicans pushed for it. And so you're going to have it. And, you know, we have a resolution that was out there on the floor, you know, to get rid of No Child Left Behind. Well, No Child Left Behind is the update of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. If we get rid of that, it's like $34 billion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get rid of, you know, cut off $34 billion to the schools in America. So we have to be realistic on how we move towards this.
Well, once again, AFT is working with the administration, working with the seats in power, to make education better, basically, not ignoring everything. Like NEA pretty much wanted to sue Nickleby out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So AFT is still taking that progressive view of saying we need to change education within, better for the kids, not fight it.
Yep.
Okay. Why don't we go into international issues?
Okay.
Let me tell me first, starting with what the Democracy Committee is at AFT, then we can move in from some of your activities.
Well, the Democracy Committee is one that was set up at the AFT to try to help trade unions in other countries. It's a very positive thing. I can remember the Congressional Committee, the Un-American Activities Committee, which was not a positive thing. You know, they were out to point the finger at anybody that disagreed with them and call them a communist. But this is... this is to find places where there are already emerging democracies, and to give them help, because I think in an emerging democracy, if you've had a dictator for a long period of time, maybe your whole lifetime, how do you relate to democratic institutions? You know, how do you? You and I disagree. I'm not going to let you have your way. You know? What do you mean? Because you had more votes than I had, you know?
Right.
So there has to be an experience that, you know, that, yeah, I lost this one, but I'm going to win the next one. I'm going to get more of what I wanted because I supported the one I lost than being on the outside. So that's the Democracy Committee. Al was always... Al Shanker was always, you know, very much for human rights and social justice. He marched with Martin Luther King. He collected money to buy station wagons, you know, UFT money to buy station wagons
mm-hmm.
for the voter registration. I mean, Al, if you trace Al, even though he had people that said he was a racist, they would be very hard to refute all of the things that Al Shanker did that made him somebody who recognized social justice and was a staunch defender of human rights.
Mm-hmm.
So Al got involved early. And at the AFL-CIO, he was on the International Affairs Committee, and he got involved in what happened in other countries. I used to always dread it when my secretary say Al was on the phone, because I meant Al was having one of these ideas. And, you know, I already had a full work day. You know, I had every minute planned, you know, right to the time I was going to go to sleep that day. And Al's on the phone, and Al's going to have an idea. So Al would start off, Tom. they just declared martial law in Poland, and a number of the activists have escaped. And they need an office. Do you have room in the NYSET office?
Jesus,
Al, you know, what is our staff going to get shot at if we bring people in there? And Al goes, well, I hope not. but he didn't say no, you know. And so we had room on the eighth floor of the building at 260 Park Avenue South. We had the New York Teacher, had the editorial offices of the New York Teacher, and we had extra room that was there. It was always, how did we get money, legitimately give money to the UFT, who was supporting so much of our program and didn't need the kind of support we gave back to the locals. But how do you recognize that and help them in their needs? Mm-hmm. So they had a floor empty on the, in their building, so we rented the whole floor. You know, in case we needed space, you know, when you needed it, it's there, right?
Yeah, right.
So we had extra space. So that's where we put the Solidarnos office that was in exile in America. And then, of course, another call came. Tom, they need printing machines
right.
in Poland. you must have some extra machines on there. So we had to disassemble machines with instructions on how to assemble them again and mail the parts in separately, you know.
So you were mailing parts actually into Poland.
Yes, so international affairs was something that was extremely important to Al. And we had the debate on support of Israel yesterday, and when I got a chance to be at the microphone, I thought it was important for me to talk about the issue of why do we as a professional union take important convention time to deal with Israel's problems?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are we doing that? Why aren't we dealing with class size and all that? And I experienced that in upstate New York, and people would go to the convention and say, why is the time being spent on international affairs? You know, so much stuff in the convention. And the easy answer to that is that in our church, or our synagogue, or our classroom, or our family, or everywhere else, social justice is very important to us. And borders don't really make a difference on social justice, because if I've got it, and across the street is another country, and they don't have it, certainly, maybe we can push ours over the border that way,
mm-hmm.
but if we don't, maybe they'll push theirs over the border on our side. So social justice, once defined, is something that we have to stand up for. And in this particular debate, who should set the conditions for the world? The terrorists or the democratic institutions that care about human rights? And, you know, that's not Hamas. You know, Hamas doesn't care about their citizens. You know, they're not spending all their time on economic development and job creation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sneaking missiles out to shoot into Israel. And so Israel gets taken over, and, you know, what does that mean to us? Well, now Hamas has got the missiles to shoot someplace else. They're going to shoot them at Israel, and maybe they're going to shoot them at where we got troops.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, pretty soon something else is going to happen. So international affairs is something we all should be concerned about, and we should define social justice. And once we've defined it, we should work to spread it. And in every case that I know of, and I don't want to be too definite because maybe somebody will come up with some new theory I never thought of, but every case that I am aware of, we don't have good social justice unless we have a democratic institution.
Mm-hmm.
And so we should be trying to spread democratic institutions and support those that are in place where they're in. And that's our international affairs. And I've been very fortunate. I've been an unofficial observer in Nicaragua for the election. The Ortega brothers identified us as unofficial observers, and they should be ignored. They have no business in our country.
Did that put the fear in you?
yeah. Well, you know, the Carter Center was the official observer for that election, but Carter stayed in Managua. So what we did, you know, we were the AFL-CIO observers. We went out to the countryside, and it was amazing. There were disputes, I'm not talking about ideological disputes, they're procedural disputes that were coming up at the polling stations that somebody had to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that they would perceive as a neutral, they would accept. And I mean, even the guy with the Russian-made rifle that was sitting there, you know, he thought it was a good idea. You know, with one of the guys, you know, from our side was claiming that it was an unfair election because they put a stamp on your hand if you voted, because they had let soldiers vote anywhere in the country. So there had to be some way to identify that you had voted once so you didn't vote a second time. And they put a stamp on your hand, and once you had an indelible stamp, you couldn't vote again. And this guy was claiming that the indelible stamp didn't work because he had rubbed off the skin on his hand to show that, you know, he had voted once and now he didn't have the indelible mark and he could vote again. So you say, well, yeah, but that's, you know, that's an extreme, you know. And ask the guy at the polling place, how many people came in with a scab right here on their hand, you know?
Yeah.
If there's somebody with a scab, you know, we're going to be suspicious of them. But if they don't have a scab on there, you know, they have a right to vote.
Oh, jeez.
And so, of course, that was a scary election because we had dubbed the Europeans and the Americans that came down sandalistas because they all had sandals on, you know? And the Ortega brothers had taken the square in front of the cathedral, and they had these big speakers. They were going to have a rock concert, and they would have a big celebration after they won the election. And they didn't win. And so when we went to the airport to leave the next day, they herded us all into one room. And, you know, we had boarding passes. Those were the days that you could get your boarding pass, you know, beforehand.
Right, right.
We had our boarding pass, and everybody with a boarding pass in this room. They put us all in the room, and then they locked us in because they still control the airport. And then they gave out duplicate boarding passes to all their sandalistas who now wanted to leave the country because there wasn't going to be any party.
Right.
And that was a little bit scary. As it turned out to be, you know, the next day we got on planes and we got out.
So you were locked in this room overnight?
They had a guard at the door, but you could get out to go to the John. You could get out for things, and that's how we found out what was going on. And but what I did with some of my friends from New York is we caught a plane to Costa Rica, which was south. Nobody wanted to go south. Mm-hmm. And then we got a plane from Costa Rica to go back to New York. So we got out that day. But the next day, the rest of the people were on the flights and out. And we went to Chile. Al had found in Chile that there was a group that was going to challenge Pinochet. And if you remember, he had written a constitution that gave him the first 8 years of the presidency. Passed the Constitution, he was president for 8 years, and then there was a free election at the end of the 8 years. So we had what was called a campaign of the no. Mm-hmm. We voted no on the campaign. That got a little antsy, too. We were in this room, and the president of the teachers was giving a speech, and it was being translated for us, you know, after the translator was a little bit delayed.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said something, and everybody looked around, and we didn't know. We waited for the translation. The translation was, you see the bullet holes in the wall. That was last week when, you know, Shea sent his men in to break up our meeting. You know, they said, holy jeez. Last week they were shooting up the walls. Oh, there's a bullet hole about this high right here. But our main problem there was to teach him how to fold the ballots because, you know, in democratic procedures that we never think about, how do you put the square paper into the slot in the box that's smaller than the square paper? We have to fold it. Well, how do you fold it? Well, you fold it in eights, you know. And so now, which ballots are valid? Only those that are folded correctly. So we had to have these classes in how you folded the ballot to make sure that people were going to have a valid vote. And of course, as the headline said in San Diego, morning after the election, he ran unopposed and he lost. And so that was that. I'm telling you about all the wins. I'm not sure my life would have been as exciting if I lost all the time. But, you know, these were two big wins. And then I was finally an official observer in the South African election, where Mandela had won. And I got to be an observer in Kazululand, which is where all the problems were.
Mm-hmm.
And Mandela made the decision that even though that was a stolen election in that province, that in order to bring the Zulus into the government, which was so important, that he would have to accept that. And so we observed a lot of irregularities and reported them, but it was an official decision to accept it anyway, that the ANC had won the election in Zululand. What happened was the police came and confiscated all the ballot boxes, took them back to the police headquarters, and then the results were announced at the police headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
But Mandela was right. Now they have a country that I don't think will ever retreat from where they're at. And he got the country started the way, and he didn't have one section breaking off and trying to go independent and all that. So I've had some terrific experience. Others that were not as exciting as being an observer in an election that we won. But we've worked with a lot of people. I went on a mission to Russia when EI was set up as a merger between IFTU and WCOTP. The Constitution called for only democratic organizations to go in. There was a third organization that was the Warsaw Bloc organization, where there was not democracies.
This was basically the Iron Curtain?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And so it was very explicit that only democracies could come in. So the Russian teachers wanted to come in. 5 million members. Did not appear that they were a democratic institution. Eddie McRoy and I were the two from America that were on part of the mission. We went over there. We got outvoted 3-2 by the Europeans who wanted the Russians in. There did appear to be a democratic organization, though we were not able to succeed on that, and the Russians came in. But I don't know, it was important to Europe, it was important to the European Union. And they don't seem to have done any damage. I don't know if they're any more democratic than they are now, but they haven't done any damage, DI, that they're in.
Hopefully they would learn more about democratic trade unions that way.
Yeah, yeah. And, I've been to Bulgaria on training sessions and to the European countries, and we went to Japan, and to view the... educational system. The reason we went there was the government had invited the Reagan administration to send a delegation over. And of course, the Japanese teachers have always been opposed to their government. They never had a government they supported. And so they wanted to try to have an alternative to the government's group. So they invited the AFT to send people over.
Okay.
And we learned a lot. A lot of people think the Japanese educational system is so great because they go to school longer than our kids go to school. Well, we found out they don't study subjects longer than our kids study. Because if you take like Tokyo, land is so expensive, there's no place for kids to play. I mean, you can't go out on the street and play. There's no place to go. So the roof of the school is the playground. And so school goes until the junta start, the special... schools which do remediation for kids. So the school goes that long, and the kids go up on the roof and play. And so, it's a longer school day, a longer school year, but there's a purpose for that. They don't have custodial staffs. The kids clean the school. That's during the school day, that goes out.
Yeah.
So we're able to learn more. And at EI and IFTU before, we were able to learn that a lot of countries will set their educational policies by what the international organization does. So it's hard for us to participate in a discussion on class size where you're trying to change the official position of class size from 47 to 45.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because, you know, we think that if you have more than 18 kids in an early elementary class, the kids aren't going to learn. But if we pass a policy of 18, then none of these countries would pay any attention to it. But if we reduce it by 2, there's a good chance that many of these countries will reduce their class size by 2, because EI has said that. Mm. And then the next time you reduce it by 2 more, and the right. next time you reduce it by 2 more. So we've learned how to be diplomats, you know, in our own little sphere, and how to go in international affairs. And hopefully we've helped a lot of these countries. There's many things, like the issue of, if you've never participated in a democratic institution, how are you going to do it? And, I went out to dinner the other night with Tony Cortese. They wanted Mr. Han to explain to the French and to the Norwegians, what it's like in China. Because the Europeans are saying, well, China looks like it's all right, you know. Mm-hmm. It's adopted entrepreneurial ways. Well, yeah, it has, but it hasn't improved the human rights of anybody, you know. Like, Americans come in and buy or set up companies, but they're making their people, as the video said today, you know, work 13 hours some days a week in dangerous conditions and all of that. So international affairs is an attempt to try to bring those things that are good about our country into some of the other countries, and to hopefully improve the social justice as we go throughout.
But was this done through, not only was it done through AFT and other state feds, but did this work you did overseas go along also with the National Education for Democracy? Is that all tied together?
Well, Ned has the advantage of having a lot of money. Well, Congress gives a lot of money, so AFT doesn't have that kind of money to, you know, maybe we can bring a couple people over for training, but mm-hmm. we can't set up an office with staff to help a country. So Ned has a very important purpose. Ned is a late-time entrance of the United States, and the Europeans have done this for a long time, you know. They've had these institutions which have supported democracies very strongly. And that's what Ned's goal is, that when there's an emerging democracy, to try to help them. When we went over to Warsaw, Poland, under the communist system, and we went to Romania too, under the communist system, the union was a branch of the government. So the union had government desks, government telephones, government paper, government pens. You know, they could have the normal operation to operate on. But once communism fell and they no longer were part of the government, there still was the union that used to be part of the government. It maintained the building, the desk, the chair, the phone. The democratic organization had to start from scratch. And so that's a lot of what you have to do. You have to help those that are starting from scratch. Members never had to pay dues.
Right.
Because the government supported it. Now you're going to have to collect dues from somebody, and you're the smaller organization. So all these things intermesh.
Okay. I think we covered international, a little education form. Is there anything else you'd like to say as part of this oral history?
No, I'm anxious to see what you produce out of this.
Well, thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.